This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah was the first Palestinian ally to engage a Zionist occupation army along the southern Lebanese border areas within hours after Israel started its onslaught on the Gaza Strip back on October the 8th, 2023. Data from the Lebanese Health Ministry indicates at least 4,063 Lebanese have been killed, including women, children, and health workers, mostly between September and November of last year. But by November the 27th, the regime in Tel Aviv accepted a ceasefire deal to put an end to the violence. A ceasefire is violated at least 800 times and continues to violate. Hezbollah Secretary General Naim Qassem has said that the movement's patience is running out, thus signaling a potential full-scale retaliatory attacks against the Israeli regime. The state of that delicate ceasefire and the ramifications of a return to full hostilities between Hezbollah and the apartheid army is a focus of this Spotlight program. And now for your guests. Joining us for the program is Mr. Saeb Shah, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast. And Mr. Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Gentlemen, hello to both of you, and welcome to you both to the program here. I guess, Mr. Saeb Shah, we'll start with you. Let's start with the obvious initial question. Why? Why accept a ceasefire you have no intention of respecting if you are the Israeli entity? Your initial thoughts, please.
The Zionist entity in the battlefield proved itself all along. It cannot fight alone. It always have the backing and supporting of the Western powers led by the United States of America. They couldn't achieve on the ground the goals of penetrating the south of Lebanon for a few hundred meters even. They aimed to reach the river of Litani, and it took them nearly 64 days to take a few hundred meters. And then after the recovery, the quick recovery of the Lebanese resistance, specifically after the Bejar attack, and it took the resistance within to be able to escalate and counterattack under 10 days after losing the late martyr Hassan Nasrallah and military and political leadership as well. So the Black Sunday, as they call it, specifically that day when the resistance showed its own arms, its own military capabilities, from the rockets to the drones, can reach everywhere in Palestine, and it did reach from Esderot near Gaza to Haifa, Tel Aviv, around the Jerusalem, and put 4.5 million settlers underground in bunkers. That shows with the capabilities of the resistance is there and strong. The Zionist entity, then the ones who were crying for the ceasefire at the time, and the Lebanese resistance, there is mounts of pressures were expressed on it from Lebanese political parties, different part of the what we call it sectarian spectrum in Lebanon, as well acted as a pressure cooker in the Lebanese resistance. That's why they thought when they do the ceasefire, then they start with the secret agreement they've done, the Zionists with the United States of America, to eat at the Lebanese territory and to try to achieve goals they weren't militarily capable of doing. I'll give you an example. Take the Syrian scenario. They didn't fire one bullet at the start, and they start with conspiracies with Turkey and other Western powers and Arabic reactionary, and suddenly, without going into details, Syria failed. They thought they can achieve that after the ceasefire in Lebanon, but they failed, since the Lebanese resistance were aware and become strong. And the saying goes, the hit doesn't kill you, make you stronger.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Laith Maarouf, thank you for your patience and welcome to the conversation, sir. Mr. Maarouf, I'd like to put the same why to you for your initial question. Why over 800 violations between November 27th and today? You figure the 27th to the 27th of December, about 30 days. We're talking roughly 37 or 38 days, 800 violations, according to the Prime Minister Mikati, completely unacceptable, also echoed by Nabi Berri and the United Nations. Your thoughts on why?
Why? Because they can. The thing is, the Zionist, whether it's in the colony or the empire as a whole, the Zionist empire governed from Washington, D.C., as long as there's nobody to stop them, they will do whatever they want to. This is what they learned from the genocide in Gaza that's ongoing, that if there is no military force to stop it, they can continue doing it. And as we see right now, they are looting parts of Syria in the south, controlling one-third of the waters of Syria in just in the last month. And so they will be continuing to violate the ceasefire here in Lebanon until the resistance actually reacts to them. And so we are all just waiting right now to see how far the patience of the resistance will last. And yesterday's speech by the new Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Qasem, indicated that patience is running out. So the Israelis don't know anything, no language but the language of force, and that's what they have to be spoken to by.
Right, and I want to put that, I'm glad you mentioned that, because Mr. Shah, Hezbollah Secretary General Naim Qasem, just yesterday said Hezbollah's patience is running out. I mean, is this what the Israeli entity wanted in the first place, is to test Hezbollah's patience, to have a pretext to say, hey, we tried a ceasefire, but they started with their retaliatory operations, not mentioning that they pushed them to this exact state?
You see, the problem in Lebanon, as I mentioned, alluded that there is sectarian forces at work. And especially I want to name two, the Lebanese forces and the Falange. These are fascist kind of political and military wings. They caused mayhem in Lebanon and they dragged it in the 70s in a civil war, nearly destroyed. And these actors working in some of them in conjunction with the Zionist entity. We remember in 1982, Bashir Ismail, who was the leader of the Al-Kata'ib, the Falange, was meeting and organizing and plotting with Sharon when they led the invasion of Beirut in 1982. So these guys, because they represent politically a part of the Christian people in Lebanon, they can exert, using the French, using the United States of America as well, and the Saudis and other Arabian reactionary forces, much pressure, which is Hezbollah as a resistant have to play carefully in there to say it's not going to. They accusing the resistance of taking Lebanon to war, while Lebanon was defended by the resistance. I am going to give an example, which is Sheikh Naeem Qasem, Secretary General of Hezbollah. Yesterday, he mentioned himself in his speech. He said that the Zionist entity reached Beirut in 1982 in a few days, and it took the resistance 18 years to liberate Lebanon. Nationalist, Islamic, other Palestinians, other resistance he's talking about. And then the lesson, he said that they reached it in a few days. And in September, aggression of 24, the Zionist entity for 64 days, as I mentioned, and he as well emphasized that point yesterday, they couldn't reach or advance more than a few hundred meters. So the military equation today in Lebanon has established that the five divisions of the elite forces of the Zionist entity, they showed what they are capable of. They couldn't even advance a few hundreds. With all the attacks was directed at the Lebanese resistance in there. What they are doing today, they are testing the patience, political patience of the Lebanese force, Lebanese political parties, and the resistance as well. Since Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government and part of the establishment in Lebanon, they have to listen to their partners in there. This is the game with the Americans, the French, and the Saudis, with their sectarian forces, I mentioned, trying to achieve kind of victory, political victory, to the Zionist entity. But I think the Lebanese resistance proved itself till now. It's a protected Lebanon from a conspiracy, a huge one, to destroy Lebanon in line with what the Zionists did in Syria.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And Mr. Maarouf, Nabi Berri, Lebanon's parliament speaker, as well as Prime Minister Najib Mikati, they both said these violations, 800-plus violations, are totally unacceptable, and they urge U.S. and the French, as overseers of this so-called ceasefire, to oversee, to hold the regime to account for all these endless violations. Where are Washington and Paris in all of this?
Well, clearly, Washington and Paris are the mother and the father of the Zionist colony, their bastard child. So they will defend that Zionist colony no matter what. And the caretaker prime minister has the authority to call on the Lebanese army to fight off the Zionist occupation and stop these violations. But since the caretaker prime minister is really you know, listening to the embassy, the American embassy in Beirut, and since the Lebanese army is also captured by the Americans, they will not be defending the country. Right now, the tools of the West, the tools of the empire inside Lebanon, are trying to pressure Hezbollah into appointing a new president by the 9th of January, and the candidates that the American embassy, the French embassy, the Saudi embassy are pushing are all anti-resistance. So, if a new president comes into power in Lebanon that is anti-resistance and the military does not do its job, and there's a lot of talk about having the head of the Lebanese military, General Joseph Aoun, to become the new president, that's actually a bad omen for the resistance. And in fact, you know, we're also all waiting for the coming of Trump on January 20th. The end of this ceasefire is supposed to be January 27th, 25th. So in reality, there will be a new change in the power dynamics and the actions on the ground once Trump comes into power. We don't know if Hezbollah is going to allow the appointment of a president by January 9th. In a way, this would not be a good idea, because it's better to have no state when Trump comes into power and maybe attack Lebanon at that time, than having a state that is and a military that is captured by the West when such an attack comes and or a return to hostilities by the Israelis happens. So we're right now kind of all waiting for how all these plots will be played out, and clearly the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, is aware of all the dangers that are being drawn around them. This is above and beyond the fact that there's all these Wahhabi death squads that are right on the border, that are waiting for any command from their masters in Washington, D.C. to attack the country simultaneously with the Zionists.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I want to put that to Mr. Saeb Shaath. How do you perceive things playing out now, Mr. Shaath? Israel says it greatly weakened Hezbollah and that the movement will take years to recover. Yet, you very well know, just today, Wafiq Safar, head of Hezbollah's coordination and liaison unit, said that the movement's capabilities have been restored and it is ready to confront any aggression moving forward from the Israeli entity. What should our concerns be of returning back to full-scale hostilities, and who does it benefit?
You see, the Lebanese resistance are very aware today of the conspiracies being blotted in Lebanon from the year 2006 onwards, and using the Hariri Assassination International Investigation or Tribunal at the time, when asked Lebanon to surrender all the Lebanese data, you mean talking about every individual's in Lebanon, information was handed to that tribunal, which the United States of Return made it available for its Zionist entity. So the infiltration inside the Lebanese infrastructure, the Lebanese information, the Lebanese health, become huge. And now the Lebanese resistance are aware of that. They are not militarily, they are capable, but they are worried from blocks which has involved a lot of Lebanese politicians being bought and paid for by the United States of America, France, Saudi Arabia, and others. This is the where the eyes have to be open, since on battlefield, the Zionist entity and all the Western elite forces, they couldn't even achieve victory in small, tiny Gaza. 64 days, they cannot advance a few meters inside the south of Lebanon with all of their blocks assassinating the leadership. So the same thing today, they are finding a way, a backdoor, a Trojan horse, which is they can destabilize Lebanon from inside, within inside. As they done in Syria, they're trying to achieve the same thing in the whole region. They are not going for an open war. They are going for Trojan horses to be everywhere. This is where the resistance eyes should be focused more today.
Thank you. And Mr. Maruf, we've seen one thing echoed here is the implementation of UN Resolution 1701 by Lebanon, by even the U.S. and the French, the U.K., the United Nations itself. 1701 resolution adopted back on August 11th, 2006, calls for a complete halt to hostilities between Hezbollah and Israel and the establishment of a weapons-free zone between the Blue Line and the Litani River in southern Lebanon, with exceptions for the Lebanese Army and UNIFIL. Please tell me how the this UN resolution is this blatantly violated by the Israeli regime today, how you attack UNIFIL peacekeeper positions, injuring UN peacekeepers. Many of those peacekeeping soldiers are from your European allies, but you're getting no repercussions, no consequences, no sanctions, nothing. Help us make sense.
Well, I think it's very clear right now that the empire as a whole, with all its components, the what we would call European vessels and others, the official religion is Zionism, where you can definitely desecrate any prophet and any religious book, except you cannot criticize the Zionist colony and the Zionist ideology. So in that sense, the empire and its component, the European vessels, they all would, are willing sacrificing their own populations for their false god. So they don't mind having a few UN soldiers that belong to their states sacrificed at the altar of Zionism. This is the reality. And of course, many Western civilians in these countries now know how they have no freedom of speech when it comes to the issue of Zionism and the state of Israel. So, you know, the United Nations is a useless organization. There is no such thing as international law as we know it. Whatever laws that were written after the end of World War II are irrelevant right now. There's no way to implement them. And the West, with the out-and-out genocide that was conducted in Palestine and the destruction and occupation of Syria by terrorists that are at the payroll of the CIA and the Mossad, that all shows us that there is no such thing as international law. And the United Nations and the UN Security Council, all resolutions that are on the book are implementable. They can't implement them. What they're asking the Lebanese people to do is to disarm themselves in the face of this vicious monster, the Zionist colony. So the United Nations will not do anything that harms the Zionist colony, and this UNIFIL force is even sacrificable for the protection of the Zionist colony.
Thank you, Mr. Maruf. Mr. Shah, seems Israel, it does not engage with sincerity, as we have seen in the ceasefire talks when it comes to the Palestinians of Gaza. It hasn't given any true concessions or kept any deals with Palestinians over the decades, for that matter, as you very well know. It did not respect the Oslo Accords. When it does reach a ceasefire, as we've seen in Lebanon, it continues violating it 20, 25 times every single day. Why does it seem like, when it comes to the Israeli regime, it is truly incapable of genuine and true diplomatic approaches to solutions to its problems?
Because the Zionist entity is an extension of the United States of America's imperialism in the region, and it acts accordingly. The Zionist entity, whatever agreement is signed to, they know it can violate it at any time, since it does that in behalf of the interests of the empire. And the Arabic regimes or any party to any agreement of the Zionist entity knows in their deep heart of hearts that's going to be violated. So the only thing, the only steps that can be taken is to develop and to build your military capabilities. The only language these guys understand as any other thug in the whole world is power and more power. This is how they deal with the region, as Netanyahu always says, by force or power and more power. to apply on Lebanon or in Gaza or in Syria or in Yemen or in the future as they plan to do in Iran. That's how they are talking. And the United States of America or the West, at the end of the day, they give the illusion that they are interested in reaching a kind of conclusion, agreement, peace treaty here or accords here and there. They are not. They are looking into keeping this area is boiling with conflicts. That's the way they make money. That's the way they can assure their domination in the region.
And we only have about 1 minute left, Mr. Maruf. I want to get that same question to you. I mean, we've seen the 360 square kilometers that Israel was quick to occupy in Syria, which is, you very well know, the exact size of the besieged Gaza Strip. We see the aggression on Lebanon, the attacks on Yemen, the attacks on Syria. We've seen a genocide in Palestine. I mean, how do you make sense of all the endless aggression and violence emanating from the Israeli entity lately? And it's showing no signs of even entertaining any path to peace.
Yes, because the Zionist colony lost the propaganda war, the war for the hearts of humanity, and everybody now on the planet hates the Zionist colony and hates its backers. Nobody, even the majority of the population in the imperial domains in Europe and North America, hate Israel. So they have no interest anymore in dialogue. The only impetus they have is to change the demographic on the grounds through genocide and mass expulsions, and that's what they are working on. And so since they have no interest anymore in playing the propaganda game, because they've lost it and there's no way they can win it, they see that the only thing that they have left for them is brute force. And as long as there is no counter force that can stop this brute use of force, it will continue.
Thank you both for joining us in the program. Stay safe. To both of you, Mr. Saeb Shafter, joining us, author and commentator out of Belfast, and Laith Maruf, also activist and political commentator, joining us from Lebanese capital, Beirut. This brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio. Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This title given to the 11th Imam, Al-Askari, is because of a military camp.
Al-Kindi, he was a philosopher who lived during the time of Imam Hassan Al-Askari. When he gets there, he finds Imam moving towards a community who are anticipating him.
This is Dialogue, an introduction on the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Hasan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam, the father of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, was the 11th Imam of the infallible Imams from the Ahlul Bayt of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. The blessed and pious Imam carried the banner of Islam, undertook the goals of the religion, and sacrificed his life unto this way. He was indeed a fountainhead of knowledge and wisdom. He faced many incredible difficulties and tragedies and hardships in order to spread and promote and keep intact the high values and goals of the religion of Islam. Truly, there are so many countless favors that have been bestowed upon the Muslims by the divinely appointed Imams, the infallible and immaculate Imams, including Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, the 11th divinely appointed Imam. There's this very beautiful conversation that we have between Imam Hasan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam and a companion from the city of Qum by the name of Ali ibn al-Husayn bin Musa bin Babway. And so, of course, this individual is quite prominent as one of the great religious scholars among the Shias. And, of course, he was from the city of Qum. And this individual was a famous jurisprudent. He was a famous faqih. He was a very well-known and distinguished personality among the Shia. He was a prominent personality when it came to the traditions and the ahadith and the science of ahadith, as well as fiqh and jurisprudence and the rest of the Islamic sciences, a very prominent and distinguished and outstanding figure amongst the Shias of not only that era, but even in the pages of history, he has been preserved as such. And so, of course, he was one of these close companions of Imam Hasan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam, the 11th divinely appointed Imam. And so in this conversation, of course, we find that Imam Askari alayhi salam, he praises the Almighty Allah when he starts the conversation. And he talks about how the end, the good end, the ultimate end is for the righteous and the muttaqi and the good people, the honest people. And that paradise is for the monotheist, the muwahid, those who believe in this Islamic monotheism in Tawheed, and that hell is for the atheists, and that there should be no hostility towards anyone except against the oppressor, and that there is no God but Allah, who is the best of creators, and the blessings be on the best of creation, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, and his pure progeny. So this is just a small part of this conversation, but so many different beautiful points, of course, that the good end and the ultimate end is for the righteous people, the people who do good deeds, and that paradise is for the people of monotheism, the people who believe in Tawheed, the people who believe in one God. And of course, this has many different aspects within it, but, you know, for example, believing in one God means that you are subservient to that one God, that you prostrate to that one God, that you consider that one God, Allah the Almighty, to be the creator and the sustainer and the ultimate power. So it's not as, you know, easy as it sounds, but perhaps it is quite easy if somebody wanted to go ahead and do what is needed. Of course, hell being for the atheists, and the last point, that there should be no hostility except against oppressors, something that in the present day is very necessary for every single one of us to voice our concern against the oppressors of the time if we want this world to become a better world in the end. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Askari, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
What I want to do today is I want to look at one particular tradition in which the Imam alayhi salam discusses qualities that he expects in the Shia. The second thing the Imam alayhi salam says, wal wara' fi dinikum, and piety in your religion. Okay? Now what is piety? Piety, wara' is a higher state than taqwa, but it encompasses taqwa, I would say. But to put it very simply, right? Al-wara or piety in Islamic literature at the first instance is to avoid that which is haram. That's what piety is, right? Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. He says, aslul wara tajannubul asam wa tanazzuhu anil haram. That the root of piety is to keep away from sin and restrain yourself from that which is haram. Yeah? Most of us should have piety by now, right? I don't think any of us here go around sinning on purpose, you know what I mean? And then build on that. But if I remember, it connects to the first point, yeah? That if I remember God more frequently, I'm less likely to sin. Yeah, I'm less likely to sin if I remember him more frequently. The times of sin come on when I have forgotten about God, right? And so like if I have a habit of watching something inappropriate on my laptop, if I have a sticky note that says remember God, it's going to be hard to watch something inappropriate on my laptop. You understand, right? That means you have to actively remove God before you do it. You understand remembering can absolutely eliminate me from doing something haram, right? And so the second point, and again, like if you have that dua that starts your, like, you know, it's hard for me to imagine that subhanallah, like that bismillah, alhamdulillah dua would come on and then right away I play music. Hard for me to imagine that happening, that you can remember God and then sin right away, right? And so the more we remember God, the less we will sin, and that's what wara is. And so as a Shia, the Imam says, I expect you to sin less.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Smoke. I heard the children scream. heard the war drum beat, gunpowder in the air, dead bodies on the street. It won't take long for the dark clouds to go, for the sun to come out and shine on my home. They waved their flag in blue and white, erected walls.
The Limelight.
Justin Trudeau will step down after 9 years as Prime Minister of Canada. Trudeau announced his intention to resign as party leader and Prime Minister after pressure from within his own Liberal Party. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Fox News Channel has covered this story and tells us more. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced on Monday, 6th of January, that he intends to resign as party leader and Prime Minister after pressure from within his own Liberal Party increasingly grew amid heightened criticism over his handling of the economy and also threats levied by President-elect Donald Trump. He said he will resign once the party selects a new leader. Trudeau told reporters, "I intend to resign as party leader as Prime Minister after the party selects its next leader through a robust nationwide competitive process. Last night, I asked the President of the Liberal Party to begin that process. This country deserves a real choice in the next election, and it has become clear to me that if I'm having to fight internal battles, I cannot be the best option in that election." Justin Trudeau added, "As you all know, I'm a fighter. I'm not someone who backs away from a fight, particularly when the fight is as important as this one. But I have always been driven by my love for Canada, by my desire to serve Canadians, and by what is in the best interests of Canadians, and Canadians deserve a real choice in the next election. It has become obvious to me with these internal battles that I cannot be the one to carry the Liberal standard into the next election." Trudeau, who led the nation for nearly a decade, has been grappling for months with significant drops in his approval ratings over mounting frustration relating to issues like soaring cost of living and rising inflation. Though there was no official path for his party to boot him from the top job, the now nearly former Prime Minister faced either the threat of a parliamentary vote of no confidence or a lengthy fight to hold on to his position until the October 2025 elections. Either option was expected to see a crushing end to Trudeau's time in office. At least seven members of his own political party in the parliament and opposition party leaders called on Justin Trudeau to step down. Following the abrupt departure of his finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, who wrote a scathing letter of resignation, citing criticisms over his handling of certain economic policies, as well as threats levied by Donald Trump. Chrystia Freeland, once seen as Justin Trudeau's chief ally and who helped oversee the 2020 US-Mexico-Canada deal during the last Trump administration, warned that how Canada responds to Donald Trump's threat of slapping 25% tariff on Canadian imports will define us for a generation and perhaps longer. Chrystia Freeland wrote, "For the past number of weeks, you and I have found ourselves at odds about the best path forward for Canada. Our country today faces a grave challenge." The incoming administration in the United States is pursuing a policy of aggressive economic nationalism. Freeland continued, she urged Prime Minister Trudeau to show more backbone when it comes to standing up to Donald Trump and his coming tariff war. The comments made by Freeland sent shockwaves across Canadian government, with many backing her calls to show strength in the face of the potentially tough economic times ahead. Justin Trudeau, who appointed close friend Dominic LeBlanc to take over as finance minister, later held a special meeting with his caucus, during which, according to Dominic LeBlanc, he said he heard very clearly and listened carefully to their concerns and he would reflect on it. It remains unclear who will likely take over Justin Trudeau's seat, but Dominic LeBlanc is said to be a leading contender. Donald Trump reacted to Trudeau's resignation in a post on his Truth Social platform. Trump wrote, "Many people in Canada love being the 51st state of the U.S. The United States can no longer suffer the massive trade deficits and subsidies that Canada needs to stay afloat. Justin Trudeau knew this and resigned. If Canada merged with the United States, there will be no tariffs, taxes would go way down, and they would be totally secure from the threat of Russian and Chinese ships that are constantly surrounding them. Together, what a great nation it would be." The Associated Press has also covered the same story. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced his resignation on Monday, 6th of January, after nearly a decade in power, bowing to rising discontent over his leadership and growing turmoil within his government, signalled by the abrupt departure of his finance minister. Trudeau, the latest incumbent to be driven out by rising voter dissatisfaction worldwide, said it became clear to him that he cannot be the leader during the next elections due to internal battles. He planned to stay on as Prime Minister until a new leader of the Liberal Party has been chosen. Trudeau wrote, "I don't easily back down faced with a fight, especially a very important one for our party and the country. But I do this job because the interests of Canadians and the well-being of democracy are something that I hold dear." Justin Trudeau was initially teary-eyed at the announcement outside of his official residence. He said Parliament, which had been due to resume on 27th of January, would be suspended until 24th of March. The timing will allow a Liberal Party leadership race. All three main opposition political parties in Canada have said they plan to topple the Liberal Party in a vote of no confidence when Parliament resumes, so a spring election after the Liberals pick a new leader was almost assured. Justin Trudeau came to power in 2015 after 10 years of Conservative Party rule and was initially hailed for returning the country to its Liberal past. But the 53-year-old politician, the son of Canada's most famous Prime Minister, became deeply unpopular with voters in recent years over a range of issues, including the soaring cost of food and housing in Canada and also surging immigration. The political upheaval comes at a difficult moment for Canada internationally. US President-elect Donald Trump has threatened to impose 25% tariff on all Canadian goods if the government in Canada does not stem what Trump calls a flow of migrants and drugs into the United States. Even though far fewer of them cross into the US from Canada than from Mexico, which Donald Trump has also threatened. Canada is a major exporter of oil and natural gas to the United States, which also relies on its northern neighbor for steel, aluminium, and automobiles. After Trudeau's announcement, Donald Trump, who for weeks has referred to Canada as the 51st state of the United States, did so again and incorrectly claimed on social media that Prime Minister Trudeau resigned because Canada relies on subsidies from the United States to stay afloat. Canada's former finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, announced her resignation from Trudeau's cabinet on 16th of December. She criticized some of Trudeau's economic priorities in the face of Donald Trump's threats. The move, which came shortly after the housing minister quit the government, stunned the country and raised questions about how much longer the unpopular Trudeau could stay on in his job.
Thank you.